I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, welcome to Nature Biotechnology's First Rounders Podcast. My name is Brady Huggett. I am the host of this show, and the guest today is Grace Colon. She is the president and CEO of Incarta Therapeutics. She is one of those people that you sometimes find in this industry that has a vast breadth of knowledge about biotech. After her PhD, she worked for a consultancy. She's worked for large companies, small companies. She has started up companies. She has worked in venture capital. Her experience touches just almost all corners of this industry. What did we discuss? We talked about her growing up in Puerto Rico, this tropical island, as she calls it. We talked about her time at MIT, which she just loved. It sort of helped set her on the path toward entrepreneurship. We talked about her deep love of musical theater. That was a surprise. I did not see that coming. And we also talked about the great bloat that you'll find in our healthcare system, and the ways that small companies, small biotechs, can maybe chop away at some of those inefficiencies. We talked about that. Anything else? I think you're ready to go. So here it is, your first Rounders podcast with Grace Colon. Listen up.
Yeah. I just got it in the last couple of weeks because I've actually been recording. I do musical theater performance, so I've been doing some Zoom stuff.
You do?
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Well, not much anymore. I'm trying to get back into it. I did a lot of musical theater at MIT, and I've sung off and on over the years, just informally. And so right now I'm recording a song with four other biotech women. It's a 1 minute song from a musical theater thing with a 5-part harmony. So, and then I did a Zoom audition class, and so I'm preparing some things and actually have a YouTube channel now with some of my performances, which I'm not going to share with you right now.
This is being recorded. Should I cut this out? This is the best stuff I've heard.
No, it's fine. We can, whatever you want to cover, I'm ready.
Right.
I know.
We'll get back to that because I want to.
No, there's a lot of biotech people in bands. I keep on finding people who either play instruments or sing or perform in some way. I think we're a very outspoken, uninhibited group of people.
I mean, you wouldn't think so, though. Most people think scientists are pretty buttoned up, but I found that not to be the case, actually.
That's not the case. Some of the craziest, most fun people were all my colleagues and classmates at MIT. So,
wow. So I was looking through, you know, your sort of long history, and I'm like, there's no way we're going to be able to cover all this. There's just so many different angles. But I feel like we should start at Penn. But
sure.
But I also wonder, like, how did you even get to Penn? How did you think that, you know, that you wanted to go to a school like that and you wanted to study chemical engineering? Was there science in your youth?
Yes, there was science, a lot of science in my youth. I mean, I grew up in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and I was surrounded just the sensory overload of growing up on a tropical island. So in a couple of ways, right? One is the beach. You know, we were never far from a beach. Puerto Rico is about 100 miles long, about 30, 35 miles wide. So you're never far from a beach and you're never far from rainforest.
Yeah.
And so from a young age, even in our backyard, we lived in a house that was actually owned by a longtime Puerto Rican family that owned a lot of land. And we lived there because my father ran one of their plants, which is a dairy plant. And our backyard was filled with iguanas and birds and huge bugs and trees and lush greenery. So from a young age, I'd go outside and play. We had a bunch of German shepherds. And I'd spend hours out there climbing trees and looking at leaves and, you know, chasing iguanas and picking up worms and just from a young age. And then I'd go to the beach and would be snorkeling and I'd be, you know, so just science. And then the nighttime, you know, would visit local islands and there's no light. So you could see the stars and the Milky Way and I'd stare at the stars. So really a youth that was just filled with childhood and youth filled with science. And then, of course, I loved science and math in school. But interestingly enough, both my grandfathers on both sides were engineers. So on my dad's side, his father was a chemical engineer, which is eventually what I ended up studying. And my father didn't study engineering. He studied animal husbandry. And he went to the mainland to study that, which is where he met my mom. But he was some people are just engineers. Doesn't matter what they study. They have that mindset and that brain. And my dad definitely was that. And then his dad, who I never met because he died in a car crash in the mountains of Puerto Rico before I was born. I was the youngest of five. And I never got to meet him. But he was a chemical engineer. And he had eight kids. My dad was the sixth. And he ran large sugarcane sort of processing plants and farms, basically. Sugarcane was a huge industry in Puerto Rico. So several of his kids studied either agriculture or animal husbandry. And, you know, he's a chemical engineer. And I still have his chemical engineering handbook. It's like second edition. I have it. That was handed down to me. And then my grandfather on my mother's side, she grew up in New Orleans. He was an electrical engineer who graduated from Tulane. And he was involved with NOPSI, which is the New Orleans sort of public service, you know, electrical utilities, grid. Right? And he helped build the grid in New Orleans, you know, starting in the 20s, you know, when he graduated. And he met my grandmother, who also worked at NOPSI, who had graduated from Newcomb. You know, was captain of her field hockey team. You know, not many women went to college, and she went to college. She studied Latin and English, and captain of her field hockey team. And they met.
What's Newcomb?
Yeah. Oh, it was sort of like the female side of Tulane. It was the sister.
Oh, okay.
School, right.
Oh, okay.
Like yeah. And so anyway, so he was an engineer. The point was he was an engineer. So I would go visit them in the summers, and he had all his engineering textbooks and chemistry. And I was a very geeky kid, as you could tell, still am. And, you know, he talked about engineering and he loved building things. He built a house in the mountains in North Carolina. We used to go visit. And so I was surrounded, no matter, I couldn't escape it. Right. I loved science and engineering. So growing up in Puerto Rico, there's a great engineering school on the island in Mayagüez, but I really wanted to go to the mainland. I felt like I wanted to go out and see the world. And
because you'd been going back and forth, you've been going to New Orleans to see
to visit. Visit. Right. Yeah. So I had a lot of cousins, you know, on my mom's side and aunts and uncles. And then a lot of obviously my island family, most of whom, the vast majority were on the island. And it was just great, great place to grow up. You know, happy to talk more about that. But the point is on the Penn side, I applied to, you know, some engineer. It wasn't like today where you apply to 20 schools. I only applied to a handful. Yeah. I had done well in school and had a lot of extracurriculars. And, you know, Penn attracted me. There was a large Puerto Rican population sort of in my community who ended up going to Penn. And what I loved about it was it's like the only school I can think of that has everything, you know, dental school, nursing school, business, law, medical. It's rare to find that all in one place. And I also had a lot of other interests, had a great romance language department. So I studied French and Italian, did a semester abroad in France. You know, the engineering school had that available to it. Not a lot of engineering schools do.
Oh my God.
And so I visited the campus, and it was sort of, you know, growing up in Puerto Rico, the U.S. is so different. It's like a culture shock. And it was sort of classic what I had seen in the movies, a beautiful campus.
Yeah.
You know, I would visit and everybody's outside partying. It's a very different kind of environment, right, than I grew up with, you know, the big old buildings and all of that. And I just fell in love with the campus. My other choice was MIT, and I got in, but I had been there for a program that they had for high school students, for minorities, you know, Black, Latino, Native American. And it was an engineering program that was lasted 3 or 4 weeks. It's still in place today. I talked to the person who runs the program recently. She came to visit me at my company, and phenomenal program. So I did, I went there between junior and senior years in high school. And
what, in the summer or something?
In the summer. It just blew my mind away. Spent, you know, 3 or 4 weeks living on campus. I think it was 4 weeks. Yeah. Living on campus and taking courses, doing civil engineering, doing English, writing for scientists, math, physics. Fell in love with it and really fell in love with MIT. But I don't know how I knew this when I was 16. When I got into both places, I said, I'm coming back for grad school. I'm coming back to MIT. Oh. And I don't know. I don't know how I knew I even wanted to go to grad school as a 16-year-old. You know, because I was like 16. I sort of was an October birthday. So I was 17 when I graduated. But I did. I somehow said Penn is perfect for undergrad. It'll be more well-rounded. It'll be, which actually is not necessarily true. MIT is incredibly well-rounded, but that was sort of my impression. And I did end up going back to MIT for my PhD, but Penn was a phenomenal place. The engineering school was tops, and, you know, had all the experience. It was everything I wanted to be, in particular doing research. So I, did work study, had a lot of student loans. My parents didn't have a lot of means. So, a lot of my classmates would, you know, go work in dining services or work somewhere else, perfectly respectable, right, to earn money to pay for work study. But I wanted a research job. So I applied for a couple of research jobs, and I got one as a freshman in the dental school department of microbiology. And I started working on oral bacteria. And so I was working, you know, with all kinds of bacteria. I was doing genetic engineering. I was working with, you know, corn cob forming bacteria, strep infusobacterium. I was doing all this stuff, and it just fell in love with it. Absolutely fell in love with research. And, you know, it was tough because I had, you know, very heavy curriculum and engineering and everything. And then I would, after classes, I would go to lab for several hours and then come back, have dinner, and then work on problem sets all night and get up and do it all again. And, you know, I'd come back in the afternoon, and my roommates who were majoring in, you know, English or whatever, you know, great curriculum at Penn, but they were done for the day and they were off partying, and I was just getting started on my homework. But loved it, absolutely loved it. And that love of research really propelled me. And then I did a research project with Doug Laufenberger and one of his grad students when he was at Penn. And then, you know, just, so I worked in dental school and in the chemical engineering department, and it just kind of sealed my fate. I said, okay, I love labs. I love research. There's so much to learn. There's so much exciting new technology. I definitely want to do this. And so I ended up, you know, having that research experience, which allowed me to apply for an NSF grant then, which I won for grad school. But then, in my junior year at Penn, I was able to do this exchange program with the Université Technologique Compiègne in France, about an hour north of Paris. And I fell in love with France. I didn't learn as much as I should have when I was there. And I somehow knew I wanted to go back.
I mean, but you just living there, you're learning on a daily basis, just living in another country, right? I mean, that's such a part of growing, really.
Oh, it was phenomenal. And I, you know, being a native Spanish speaker, it's my first language as much as English is. It was not too hard to learn French. I took a bunch of advanced courses at Penn, and then immersed as a student, I became quite fluent and even slang and all of that. And, you know, had a lot of friends from there, and then ended up spending the summer hiking in the Pyrenees and camping out and almost not coming back. And then, I did come back, got an internship at Merck and Rahway, back when Rahway was in the headquarters. And then decided I'm going to put off grad school for a year and go back to France. I don't know why I did that, but I did. I said, I can always come back. Merck had a plant in the middle of nowhere in France in a little town called Epuy. And the plant manager I worked for was a real champion for me and was able to make connections there. And they had a position for me to go back and be environmental engineer. So I took a year off and went and worked in France.
Wow.
But that didn't start till like January of that year. So I moved to Paris with a friend of mine and walked into the Pasteur Institute to try to find a short-term internship, and was able to find one with one of the leading researchers there for 3 months. So, you know, I worked in Paris as a researcher at the Pasteur Institute for 3 months before going off to Merck.
I mean, you seriously walked in and said, hey, yes. I'm here for a few months. And they said yes to that.
It was crazy. I mean, this is before internet, before anything. I don't know how we got stuff done back then. I can't remember how we did these things, but I had a little resume I'd printed out that showed, you know, I graduated from Penn. I had done all this research. I had the Merck internship. I had, you know, I had papers published and genetic engineering. And this was the Département de Recombinaison Génétique or something like that, you know, genetic engineering department. Pierre Thiollet was the name of the head of the department, I remember. And he was doing hepatitis B research in transgenic mice. And he had me work with a postdoc. And I just walked in and I said, here's my resume. Do you have any, you know, short-term positions? And they had funding and they could always use an extra hand. And I seemed like I wasn't a complete idiot. So he said, sure. And I'm well, is it paid? And yeah, it was 5,000 francs a month, which was nothing, but you know.
Well, still, yeah. But I'm so like, why do you think that happens? Just because there's a tendency of people to want to help bright young people who are making their way or what? I mean, when you say you can only have me for 3 months and they go, yeah, we'll give you money to
yeah, you know. They cannot. I mean, when I got to the lab, I realized they could use extra hands. I mean, having been in labs myself as a grad student, you know, we'd have undergraduate researchers come in, you know, dying to add to their resume, get some experience. And there's always stuff to do. There's always like, you know, things, the repetitive experiments you need to do. And if they look like they've had some experience, you know, he knew his postdoc needed some help. And they said, you know, if she's done all this, graduated from a decent school, you know, what can it hurt, right? Worse, they waste a little time training her and it's not a lot of money. And frankly, yeah, there's got to be a spirit of generosity and mentoring. Because otherwise, why would you bother? It's kind of a hassle to take somebody on for a couple months.
Train them. Yeah, exactly. And, yeah.
But, you know, as a young person, you don't think that. You're like, oh, I'm so great. Give me a job. You know, I'll work hard and really, really. And look at my French. Isn't my French good? You know?
Yeah.
Well, I did it all in French. I spoke to him in French and said, just, you know, je m'appelle, blah, blah, blah. And, you know.
You were right, though.
Yeah.
I mean, well, they didn't regret it, I'm sure.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully I contributed. I mean, you can't do much in 3 months, but I remember I did, you know, advance some little pieces of the research that was helpful or so they told me.
I want to ask this too, going way back, but so because your father had come to the US, you said too, for school, right? So that's another reason why you're like, okay, well then this is kind of how the pattern goes. I mean,
Yeah. I mean, the difference is he went, you know, he married my mom, they lived in Louisiana, but then they ended up going back and forth. So I'm one of five and my oldest sister was born in Lafayette. So they went to school in Lafayette, what is now the University of Louisiana Lafayette, I think. The name changed over the years. At one point it was University of Southwestern Louisiana, you know, great school. Several of my relatives either went there or to LSU. And actually my three sisters all went to USL undergrad.
Huh.
So when I applied to schools, my parents wanted to keep me down south near the family. And they said, okay, if you must go to the mainland and you want to study engineering, we understand USL might not be the place, but at least go to Tulane. So I applied to Tulane, got in, phenomenal school.
Yep.
But, you know, Penn like grabbed my imagination and, you know, I wanted to go there. So I ended up doing that.
And then what about too, cause you said, you know, that growing up on the island is just beautiful and, you know, New Orleans has a real beauty to it. I've always found, I don't know that you can say that about Pennsylvania as much. So was that kind of, I mean, look, I love Pennsylvania, but was that a big change for you too, to spend winters at Penn?
It was very hard from that perspective. You know, growing up on a tropical island, you have no idea how to dress for the winter. You know, you either, I remember borrowing like just these awful clothes from relatives and friends, like these huge bulky sweaters and like, I didn't have the right boots. And you don't realize that you don't bundle up and then you go into this hot classroom, right? And I'm just sweating. So the idea of layering was just no clue. Right.
Yeah.
The idea of proper boots that aren't going to get, you know, I lived on the opposite side of the engineering school. So trudging through 20 minutes to get to an 8 a.m., you know, engineering class, was not very smart. And we didn't have a lot of money. So I could not go out and just buy a new wardrobe, right? I had to make do. I mean, I'm making it sound like we weren't poor, but we didn't have, you know, the means to just, you know, I had to make do with what I had, right?
Yeah.
And so that was a big shock, right? But you know, I also knew it wasn't, you're not going to, as an undergrad, it's not like you're going to be out in the town every night. So I wasn't so much looking at Philadelphia as, oh, this is a place to go, or New Orleans, I'll go there and party. It's like, what, it's about the school, right? Frankly, because you're going to spend all your waking and sleeping hours there pretty much. So it wasn't so much about that. I think it's a little bit different in grad school, you know, when you realize you might have a little bit more time, or I don't know, you're just thinking a little more broadly.
Yeah.
So that was kind of a no-brainer for me to go to Penn.
But that sounds, I mean, I think that a lot of kids actually do think about what school they're going to, you know, how much they're going to party at school, et cetera. what city is it close to? But that's sort of telling me that you were pretty focused on the education from the get-go.
I was. I mean, come on, I'm out there playing with iguanas and, you know, snorkeling. I had a lot of friends. I was involved in a lot of social things, but I still am such a geek at heart. Like, I was so excited about the classes and about the research. I mean, it was miserable. It was hard.
Yeah.
I didn't have the high school training that a lot of my counterparts had. I really, really struggled. I did fine, but it was I didn't have AP courses. I didn't have anything, you know, so I had a lot of catching up to do. So it was hard. I mean, I will not lie to you. It was, you know, I loved it, but at the same time, it was really, really hard. But I think the love outweighed the difficulties.
Yeah. So I'm making some assumptions here, but it sounds like, okay, you're leaving the beautiful tropical island and coming to Pennsylvania. You're not quite prepared for the climate change. And also you realize that there are probably people there who were better prepared by their high school than you might have been. So is this all kind of a culture shock? Did you have that feeling where you're like, do I really belong here? Is this place for me? That sort of thing? You did.
Yeah, I did. And also the other thing that was a big culture shock was kind of the whole fraternity and sorority culture. That's just, it's never been me. I mean, I like to party as, you know, with the rest of them. You know, I'd go to some of these parties, but it's just not my thing. I was incredibly fortunate to be put in a dorm called Van Pelt College House. I think the name has changed several times now, that was filled with people just like me. It was the geeks, the engineers, the foreign exchange students, the artists. And we did coffee houses, you know, talent shows every quarter. We went and watched, I don't know how many, you know, Star Trek TNG, the year it came out. I was in college and we were watching it in my friend Tim's room, and we were watching Princess Bride on Laserdisc, right? This is what we would do on the weekends, right? Yeah. We'd sit and we'd talk of science and sci-fi. We'd play guitar. I sang in bands. And we talked sci-fi all day long, went to sci-fi conventions, went to, you know, Society for Creative Anachronism. And those were my peeps. So I had those people. I had the people I did research with. I had my engineering classmates, some of whom I'm still dear friends with.
Yeah.
You know, it's like with any college, you find your peeps and you make a home. Right. So for me, Penn was just amazing that way. Right. I had my dorm and everything else.
Huh. Okay. So then you come back from France for MIT.
That's right. So I got into MIT. I got into I was very fortunate, right? I got accepted into some phenomenal chemical engineering graduate programs, Wisconsin, Minnesota, MIT, and a couple others. And I love to tell the story. I came back in February when I was in France to do the final visits to decide. And I show up to, it's February. So I show up to Minnesota and the snow's up to here. Right. Yeah. And I'm going through the tunnels. I'm going, wow, phenomenal program. But I don't know how I do this. Yeah. Right. And then I go to Wisconsin. The snow's down to here.
Yeah.
And then I go to Boston, and it's one of the crazy Boston weather days that it's 60 degrees and sunny in February. Everybody's partying. Everybody's out. The chemi grad students take me out partying and say, you got to come here. It's a great place, whatever. And I'm kidding aside, I did not make it on the base. Decision on the basis of that, but it was just kind of funny that I showed up for the visits and I was like, okay, I'm coming to MIT. Well, plus I still had that connection from the program done all those years before. Yeah,
that was still kind of number one in your heart then, MIT maybe.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Always. And that was, you know, as great as Penn was, MIT just, I just loved every minute of it there.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
So did you, as we look at your career, did you get this? Did you pick up the entrepreneurial vibe at MIT? I mean, I've met so many people in this industry who have come through MIT one way or another, as far as entrepreneurs go. And I just think it breeds them.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was incredibly fortunate at MIT to be co-advised by some amazing folks in the industry, and also to see. So my main advisor at MIT and Kemi was Greg Stephanopoulos.
Yeah.
He was brilliant. In metabolic engineering, which was what my PhD thesis was on. But I was also co-advised by Tony Sinski, who is entrepreneurial in his own right. And I also, one of my dear housemates, Mark Prausnitz, who's now a professor at Georgia Tech, his advisor was Langer.
Yeah.
So I was seeing all this innovation going on and just being blown away by these companies being created. Also, my PhD work generated some technology. We eventually didn't get the patents granted, but it had to do with overproduction of various amino acids in lysine-producing organisms. And we licensed it to Archer Daniels Midland. So I got royalties for a few years for that technology. You know, not a lot, but enough to buy a nice bottle of wine or something. But the point is, I could see the connection between coming up with new discoveries and actually potentially having a commercial application. So I got introduced to that through my work there. Absolutely loved the idea and was really, still fascinated by the whole concept of being able to engineer microorganisms or engineer cells to make whatever you can think of, inputs and outputs, and then it all has to fit in a certain economic equation to make sense. But I was hooked, right? I was like, this is phenomenal, right? So it wasn't so much the biotech healthcare applications that I started with. It was really the industrial biotech applications. And I know Tony started, metabolics, and I know you talked to Tillman earlier about metabolics and all that. So I was there when that was forming. So bottom line, yes, absolutely. The entrepreneurial fire.
Yeah, you went in thinking, I love research, I love being in the lab, and came out understanding that those things had ties to industry. If you wanted them, they were there. You could take that work and it could go out and be something.
That's right. And I saw it all the time, right? They were always starting companies. I mean, it was interesting because I was never really interested in the business side. Even when I was at Penn, some of my best friends were Whartonites, right? And so they were doing the whole business thing. And I was like, money, that's so boring. Who cares about finance, accounting? That's I never want to do business. Like, that was my general simplistic view. And likewise at MIT, I was like, it was just all about the science. But the problem is, I finished my PhD and then did a postdoc for a year just because I was still deciding what I wanted to do. And I woke up in horror one day when I realized, why did I do my PhD? What am I going to do with it? I mean, I don't want to be in the lab forever. I do love the lab, but I wanted to be out there, whatever out there meant. And then I realized, okay, I got a couple offers to do lab work and kind of industrial postdocs, if you will, and in some of the local pharma companies at the time. There weren't that many there at the time. And I said, oh my God, no, I don't want to do that. And my professors were telling me, you know, you'd be make a great professor. Your research did well. You know, we can connect you. There's positions at all these other places. We can put in a good word. I'm like, I saw what you went through with grants and politics and trying to, you know, I don't want to do that either. And I went, oh, what am I going to do with my life? And then, you know, so it was a real wake up moment. I realized I had no plan. I just did it for the love of it throughout. And it wasn't until some of my friends were interviewing at McKinsey that I discovered there was this whole other option that I hadn't even considered. And that's how I ended up down that path.
Okay. So tell me about that. So this, I think, I mean, I've heard that McKinsey, you know, they, so you didn't have any business background, right? And their consultancy,
None.
Really. But they had begun to hire people who were intelligent in other ways than maybe they could make up. You know, see what I'm saying? Like you knew lots of things about research and maybe even how that's tied to industry, and you could pick up the business like that.
That's exactly right. And so I think what happened, if you think about this, was in 1996 when I finished my postdoc, and they were going to Harvard and MIT and Stanford and you know Northwestern and all the top schools because they realized, you know, they were hiring the top couple percent of MBAs from the top schools. And they were growing so fast. There's only so many of those people to go around, and they're competing with them for investment banking and all these other things. And they said, where else can we find smart people? And at the same time, I think they realized that smart could mean different things. Like exactly like you said, it didn't have to mean an MBA degree and all this other stuff. It could be complementary to that. You could take JDs, you know, with sharp legal minds that could add to the team, PhDs, not just in science and engineering, but also, you know, I worked with PhDs in linguistics and English at McKinsey. And then, of course, MDs, right? So we call them APDs, you know, advanced professional degrees. And of course, it's, you have to do with a TLA, a three-letter acronym, because everything at McKinsey was TLA. So the TLA for this was APD. So they were hiring APDs, and they were hiring like crazy. And so they'd come up and, you know, here you are, a starving grad student used to whatever. And they wine and dine you these incredible seminars that they would hear. And they had all this wine and a big spread. And they had these glamorous people coming up and saying, oh, and I was in Sweden last week and I traveled to Thailand. I did this project and that project. And I met, you know, first name basis with CEOs of, you know, Fortune 50 companies. And you're going, wow, that's so glamorous and exciting.
Yeah.
And you can learn all this stuff and they pay you a lot of money and they do all that. You know, but all kidding aside, aside from the superficial aspects of it, I actually, something sparked, you know, in talking to some of them, I was like, wow, this is really interesting. You learn how, you know, I had been to the campus at Archer Daniels Midland and saw the impact of all how the technology came together and made products and, you know, little something clicked and said, okay, maybe this business thing, as I call it, isn't so bad. You know, I really need to learn that and grow. So I went through the interview process and, you know, made it through. It was incredibly rigorous. And I was fortunate enough to be chosen, and I started in the Stanford, Connecticut office. And so I ended up being there for 4 years at different offices because we moved around a few times. You know, I was married another guy from MIT and we ended up moving. So I was at one year in the Connecticut office, 2 years in the Pittsburgh office, and then 1 year in the San Francisco office. And I did not just biotech work, but high tech work. You know, with major technical companies, pulp and paper, hospital consolidation, you know, all kinds of interesting projects. You know, I did a project in Sweden for the medical device company. It was an amazing experience.
What were you doing? Were you're writing up like white papers on these companies?
So the way it works is, so there's kind of three big buckets, right? Operations, organization, and strategy. And almost anything can fit into one of those buckets, right? And now, of course, there's more ways to look at things. But, you know, so it might be a company that needs to do a massive, you know, cost restructuring. Those were kind of the ones we didn't like to do because they're not always pleasant, but they're important. Yeah. And you can bring best practices and principles for whether it's purchasing or, you know, headcount, better utilization, better organizational structure. I viewed it as a training, right? Yeah. As to be able to go in, get this training and get propelled into a whole new set of opportunities, which is what happened. I got hired by a client, one of my last projects.
Was it Affymetrix?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was Sue Siegel.
Oh, yeah.
Still a phenomenal amazing person, leader in the industry, is very fortunate to work with her. And she offered me a job after I did a couple of projects for the team, working with some great partners and associates. And it was at a very exciting time. You know, it was 2000, human genome had been sequenced. Yep. Affymetrix was really a leader.
They were everywhere. Yeah,
everywhere. And especially in oncology, you know, expression for oncology. So it was a great time to join, really phenomenal team. I'm still good friends with many, many of my Affymetrix colleagues. And
you went in as a business position though.
I went in as a business position. Yeah. I was able to go in as the title was VP of corporate planning.
And so you, from there, I think you went to Gilead.
Yes. I went to Gilead at a really exciting time. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me about that.
So they were building a commercial strategy group headed by Howie Rosen, who's still a friend. He's wonderful. And he had been at Alza and a number of places. And he was building a group under Kevin Young that was really focused on, you know, the company was really at an inflection point, right? Trying to expand from beyond virology, beyond HIV and HBV, to begin to look at new indications. And also, how do you, you know, when you own most of a market, how do you continue to drive growth there? And so they were building a team to really formalize these processes, right? Looking at, you know, 5 and 10 year commercial strategic plans for the existing franchises and also expanding into others. And so I was hired to head the group under him that was responsible for the strategic planning aspect of it, right? So he had franchise leaders. And then in my group, I built market research, competitive intelligence, modeling and forecasting, and, you know, working closely with the corporate development group, which was quite small, consider an amazing group of talented people who've gone off to do amazing things. But it was a small group, right? They needed more resources. So we collaborated with them on a lot of the support for the corporate development assessments. But we also worked internally with the R&D group to look at new franchise areas, look at new growth areas for the existing ones. So I did that. And then when I did, when we integrated all these new companies, you know, I was working directly for John Milligan for a bit. And I went to him, I said, John, we have all these alliances. You know, I noticed R&D has some alliances, commercial, there's some research ones and development ones. And I'm getting tight, pulled into them because I'm helping you with these new companies. And they said, we don't have an alliance management group. You know, it's kind of, everybody doesn't know where to go. Where do you finance, legal, and how do you deal with this milestone and that information? And how do you make decisions with the partner? He says, well, go figure it out. So I put on my McKinsey hat and I picked up the phone and I started calling alliance management groups all over pharma. Because it's not competitive to just ask them, how do you guys do it?
Yeah.
Like, how big is your group? Do you report into corporate? Do you report into R&D? Who do you report to? What kind of people do you hire? What is the role of the alliance manager? So I put together, and then I went internally to all the functions at Gilead, and I talked to the head of manufacturing, the head of IR, you know, everybody. And I said, what are your concerns? What do you know about these alliances? I put together a kind of a list of the 50 or however many alliances we had. Who knew what about them? What were the obligations? What was going on? And I said, I think you need 4 people of these backgrounds. You can give the commercial ones to this person, whatever. And I mapped it out. I give him this McKinsey-like deck. And he looks at it and he goes, great, go build the group. So I went and I built the group. So,
you know, I like that. You know, you hear this all the time about CEOs. You can't do everything. And when you come across somebody who can do the job, to just delegate and let them do it. And he'd found that in you. It's just like, you do it. I don't need to think about that. You can do this, then go do it, right? I mean, that's a relief for the CEO to just go, that's, Grace has this taken care of.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was really fun. It was a fun project because I think it was nice that the various functional leaders felt heard and they said, oh, great, this will solve my problem. Because like, I'm in legal and I get these documents requesting, you know, to sign this paperwork or this deal or this milestone I have to approve. And I wasn't quite sure who to go to. So you're making my job easier. So it was nice to be able to address, you know, issues that everybody was having.
What do you think about, because I've been thinking about Gilead a lot lately. When you sit and think about what they've done as far as their tackling of HIV and then Sovaldi, mm-hmm. for Hep C, I mean, those are, you can die with that legacy and be happy. And I sometimes I feel like the general public doesn't really know what that company has done. I mean, I understand that they licensed in some of those things and then developed them themselves, but what did you make of the culture while you were there?
Well, it was interesting. You know, when I was there, we didn't have any commercialized products that we were commercializing that we had invented at that point. If you think about it, the one invention
they brought
that
in
point that was commercial. Exactly. So the one product that they had commercialized that was commercial, they didn't market. That was Tamiflu. Right. Yep. And so it was interesting. So it was a culture that was really, they had a great R&D group, great research group, but you know, a lot of the commercialized pieces were, you know, in licensing. So so that's a capability of itself, is identifying these potential winners and then developing them. This is a clinical development machine at Gilead, you know, under Norbert, who was fortunate to work with. And of course, you might argue virology, it's a little bit different than other, you know, than oncology and other areas in terms of a little bit, I don't want to downplay it, but, you know, endpoints are clear. You kind of know what you're looking for. You replicate that and do that very, very well. When you start looking at new therapeutic areas, it's different endpoints, different challenges, a lot of learnings across the value chain, right? So they were really good at that. But then they started, then they had, you know, innovations that they did bring into play that they mixed into some of the combos. And then they had other things that they built on and brought forth. Back to the legacy thing. I mean, I think the challenge is when you're a public company, there's certain growth expectations. And I remember modeling when we were in this strategic planning group, we would model kind of, here's the analyst expectations of the growth of the various revenue streams. And then the gap was getting bigger and bigger. So in other words, if you projected the revenues from all the known programs, and then you looked at sort of what the analysts were expecting implicitly in the stock price, there's a huge gap that got bigger. So that's the gap we were trying to fill, either with additional products through the existing franchises or through, you know, acquisitions. And I remember looking at, you know, HCV early on, we modeled that out. We said, this is what's going to happen to the HCV market. But it's going to add all this value, but it's going to be a challenge. And we were modeling that many, many years before we finally made the acquisition. We did look at that early on.
It's funny. I don't think I knew or thought about that. When you're thinking about the growth of the company, you actually are sort of played up against what the analysts have said.
Yeah. And so you really need to find that growth. And that is a challenge. It's almost like it is pretty thankless, unfortunately, with these companies. You do all these amazing things and the markets have short-term memory. It's like, great, you did that. Now what else are you going to do for me?
I want to ask about this too, because it seems like another area where you just went in and added something to your own arsenal, right? New Science Ventures.
Yes. Yes.
How did you get involved in that?
So it's a little convoluted. So when I left Gilead, I ended up going to Intrexon for a couple of years, and then I left there. And at that point, I had sort of, I knew I really wanted to do a startup, and I really wanted to either start something myself or get involved with startups, because the Intrexon experience, I built a division from scratch. It was kind of like a startup, and really loved it. And so I co-founded a company that ended up not really, unfortunately, being successful, but it was a great experience. It was a glycosylation early stage company looking at post recovery. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And I was looking to, I co-founded it with a colleague of mine from Intrexon, and I sort of taught myself how to start a company. Around the same time I was doing that, one of the people involved in that was a mutual friend, you know, John Patton. So originally from Inhale, then Nektar Therapeutics. And he was chair of Incarta at that time. And they were looking for a CEO because they had this fantastic idea and early work that they had done. And, you know, fast forward, that's the company I've grown today. But at the time, I was looking for funding for both of those companies. And so I was learning how to fundraise. I was tapping, you know, knocking on every door. And I went to a former classmate of mine, Vivek Mohindra, who was in my class at MIT, one of my favorite classmates. He was approached by a former mutual colleague of ours from McKinsey, Soma Subramanian, who had co-founded New Science Ventures. And he was a partner at NSV. And I called him up to see if NSV might be interested in investing. So in our conversation, they ended up not investing, but they said, hey, we've been looking for a biotech partner. We have Vivek on the tech side, we need a biotech partner, and you have everything we're looking for. You've been in practically every corner of biotech. your MIT, McKinsey, you know, this is perfect. And I said, great, but can I still do these projects on the side? Are you okay with that? And they said, yes. So I joined as a partner and helped co-lead a number of investments, but also help some of the existing companies, you know, went on the boards of them or took interim CEO roles to try, you know, pivot them or help them. I learned what investors are looking for. So that was very helpful with my own fundraising.
Right.
But then things started taking off with Incarta, and one of their investors actually ended up, or their one of the groups that they invested with a lot ended up leading our Series A. That was Morningside. We'll always be very grateful about that. And then started getting busier. And, you know, I had to have a conversation saying, well, you know, does it make sense on both sides to, I can't really be a partner in the next fund because, you know, I've got this going on. So I stayed as an advisor for a couple of years and continued to help with the companies, but then Incarta kept on progressing. So I had to then say, I got to roll off these boards. I need to dedicate pretty much full time to Incarta.
Yeah. Yeah. That's when, you know, when I look at your career, that's one of the things that I noted too, is that you are at this point really well-rounded. You started with the science, then you started getting into consultancy, and mm-hmm. then you're in big companies. You're looking at clinical programs, industrial biotech. And what you didn't really have really was the venture side. And of course, then you went and got that. So now do you feel like you are completely prepared for whatever this industry has to offer? I mean, you could run small companies. You could go back to a large company. If you wanted to do more VC, you could.
Yeah. I mean, I feel really fortunate, right? I've had, and people often ask me about my career, like what was my big plan? And you probably hear this all the time. There's no plan. You know, you set a direction, you follow your passion and you do that. So in terms of being prepared, I feel like I do have a really well-rounded background. And the other thing is I have so many interests that I do feel that, you know, my ideal career kind of, you know, I'm absolutely passionate about Incarta, and we could talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But I feel that a next stage in a career would be, how can I get involved with multiple companies that are in different aspects of, you know, exciting technology, you know, microbiome, cell therapy, you know?
Yeah, I think that's sort of my question. There are people who, when they start their career, they think, I'm going to work in gene therapy. Mm-hmm. And then they do that for 50 years, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's great. But there are also people who want to do different things all the time. And you seem like you're in that second bucket.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, on the one hand, I'm, you know, I get dedicated and, you know, passionate about something. You know, I've been with Incarta for the last 7 years and I'm not going anywhere anytime soon. But I've done a lot on the side, right? And I've been able to do that, right? Especially in the earlier days when, you know, there was still some capacity to do that. And frankly, some need, because in the early days when you have no money, you know, you can dedicate time to it, but still spend a little time on some other things, because a lot of times it's synergistic, right? If you're doing some other things, sometimes that brought me investor relationships that I could then use for my company. So there's some synergies in being in an ecosystem where you're having lots of conversations with investors, for example, or with pharma.
So I want to ask this too, because I saw that you're an advisor for the Miller Center for Social Entrepreneurship at Santa Clara. How did you get involved in that? And then just tell me sort of what that means.
Oh, absolutely.
What social entrepreneurship is. Yeah,
absolutely. So that, so it used to be called the Center for Science and Technology. It's been around for 20 years. It's really a phenomenal center that is dedicated, you know, has a broad mission of improving the planet through social entrepreneurship. And, you know, a lot of organizations are doing that and doing, you know, exciting things around that. But what was unique about the Miller Center is they're really focused on enabling social entrepreneurs for the long term by providing tools and support and mentors. They have over 100 Silicon Valley experienced executives who are mentoring these companies from all over the world and very focused on business models and profitability. Because what you really would like to do to help developing countries is really empower the citizens and empower local entrepreneurs so that they can build sustainable businesses. It's not about charity. It's not about, I'll give you a grant. It's, how do I enable you to take a local need in your market, bring technology, bring solutions, bring, you know, existing things that could be replicated from elsewhere, you know, water franchising model that can happen in any country. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect is, you know, connecting them to capital, right? Because mm-hmm. there's a lot of social capital right now. And then part of that is the intellectual rigor of coming up with return models for that capital. And then the other aspect of it is, of course, students. So they have an honors program for seniors at Santa Clara to spend, you know, really get connected to social entrepreneurship. And they spend a summer before their senior year working, basically interning with different social entrepreneur enterprises all over the world. And so we as advisory board members work with, you know, the center and help them think about strategy and come up with things like one of the things I was very big on early on was this whole replication. How do you replicate all the wonderful findings from a company that has had a successful business model, whether it's solar ovens, whether it's apps for farmers that they can download for weather or fair pricing or whatever. There's a million types of things.
I mean, the thing that has set the U.S. biotech industry apart, by the way, is its access to capital for years and years. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know that. So it's that sort of idea, like, okay, if you have someone who's willing to invest in you, how do you handle that money? How do you find a way to return it to the LPs? How does this whole thing work? It's like that.
That's right. Well, it's that, but it's also access to resources, to business models, to
mentors, as you said. Yeah.
And it might not even be, it doesn't have to be high tech. It can be low tech, but it's, you know, there's very bright people who might not have access to education and capital and, or they do have access to education. They don't have the capital. And they don't have mentors or experience to know how to do stuff. But the fire in the belly is there. And that's common to an entrepreneur, no matter where you are.
Exactly.
Whether it's Guatemala, Namibia, the U.S., you know, it's just and there's that connection, right? That sense of recognition when you meet fellow entrepreneurs, you share that passion.
I want to ask you this. I don't know if you have an opinion on it, but so when the pandemic first started happening and everything was shut down, you know, my first thought was, okay, the markets are going to close and that's going to then dry up VC spending for biotechs. And we're going to sort of go into a biotech recession. That has not been the case at all. And I'm wondering what you think about the health of this industry.
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I think one of the, as we all know, one of the reasons so much capital has been driven into biotech is people are afraid to put capital in other sites. I mean, it's like with anything happens, right? You have macro trends and all of a sudden the capital flows to whatever they feel they can benefit. And it's interesting because it's very short-term thinking. I mean, I mean, I'm glad the money's flowing to biotech right now, but that same short-term thinking might make it, you know, slow down once biotech's no longer, you know, the viewed as the top and only option, right? Except for some exceptions and notable exceptions in tech.
Yeah.
So I think that the health of the industry, a lot is going to depend on, you know, we already knew, for example, the patent cliff and, you know, how can the industry transform itself? I think one of the things that I've seen being in the segments of biotech that I've been across and in healthcare is that there is a not enough of a connection of on the total cost of care. This is why in the last few years I've developed a real passion for chronic care management, whether it's cardiology or respiratory or diabetes. I think that a lot of what the industry was doing before was let's develop these innovative, expensive drugs. And, you know, we'll you know, there'll be a certain attrition rate and then we'll, you know, have the price and that'll fund the R&D dollars.
Yeah.
That is not sustainable necessarily in its current form in the long term, because we've seen that the cost of healthcare, well, for one, the cost of healthcare is so much more than just the drugs, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's a lot of innovation to be untapped that doesn't have to be the sexiest, latest innovation, you know, that's the only solution to the problem, right? There are things that we have today, whether it's generic drugs, whether it's innovative ways of delivering those drugs, whether it's patient management and integration with patient activities and data that can help you drive decision-making and care decisions. You know, I'll give you an example. So COPD, you know, I don't know, $50 billion cost to the industry, the healthcare industry or more. And a lot of the cost is exacerbations, right? That's a big driver of cost in later stage COPD. But what if you could, you know, slow the progression of the disease, not necessarily through an individual, you know, an individual new drug, but by decreasing the chances that you will exacerbate, because that drives the progression as well. So if you could do that by a combination of apps and wearables and patient symptomatology, so that as soon as you start getting a disease activity that's going up, you can do an intervention. That intervention might be, come in, we're going to give you steroids for a few days, or we're going to give you some respiratory therapy, or we're going to, oh, you know, it's now, you know, winter, so you're likely getting an infection. Let's keep an eye on that. There's a lot you can do that could hopefully decrease the progression and decrease, you know, exacerbations. You know, that's what one of my companies is focused on, by coming up with a better measurement of disease activity that is integrated with other, you know, a set of biomarkers and algorithms that can be integrated with wearables and other tools and patient apps. So there's a lot of innovation. What I would say is big I, that looks at the totality of the problem. And then how do you pay for it? So you go to a value-based healthcare system and you say, if you know, I'll help you manage your risky population by helping you focus resources on those at the highest risk. That's a hard problem to solve. And it's easier to just say, I'm just going to go invest in a fancy drug. Nothing wrong with fancy drugs. I love biotech. I'm in biotech. Right. My point is that shouldn't be the only solution.
I just had knee surgery, right? A really minor knee surgery, a tiny meniscus tear. You know, you walk in, you walk out. But, and I have insurance, but what the hospital wanted to bill for that surgery was like $30,000. And if you don't have insurance, you're shit out of luck with that.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was looking at those bills coming in, and yes, my insurance had covered and knocked down the price and blah, blah, blah. But I'm like, this is so out of whack. If you did not have insurance and you were a person and you're with a family, you wouldn't go have knee surgery because you're not going to spend $30,000 on it. And no, I look at that and I'm like, it's so broken. I don't know how we fix that thing.
It is absolutely broken, whether it's pricing transparency, whether, you know, it's just so crazy. It's like, you know, each place does it differently. I mean, there's no transparency. Yeah. There's no real accountability. There's no follow through. There's no connection to outcomes and quality. I mean, there's so many things that are broken. And so not to get into politics, but on the one hand, you know, people have a knee-jerk reaction when you start talking about things that reek of, you know, single payer or reek of, you know, government healthcare. I don't think it has to be all the way one or the other. I think there are elements that have been implemented in other countries and other systems that help with some of the craziness, right? There's some basic common sense things we could be doing that won't destroy, you know, innovation, that won't destroy businesses, but at the same time can make things better. But you have to fix it all kind of at once, and that's not going to happen. So I'm hoping that one way we can address it is through innovation that integrates these things and then makes it a no-brainer. Sounds very idealistic, but I'm going to, that's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with being idealistic. I mean, that's, we should be that way. But so the things you're talking about are like, okay, if we get into this chronic illness earlier and then they don't exacerbate, then they don't go to the hospital, which keeps that amount of money out of the healthcare system, right?
And it's better for the patient because if you're delaying progression, I mean, so a perfect example is what we're doing at Nkarta, right? So right now there is no way to treat, if I have an episode of AFib, so AFib is a progressive disease, right?
Yeah.
And it's, there are several stages. It's defined in three, but the first stage is paroxysmal where all of a sudden you, oh wow, my heart feels funny. You feel skip beats. In many cases, your heart rate's very high. You're dizzy, feel very anxious. And then in that early stage, those episodes can go away in seconds, minutes, days, you know, up to 7 days. That's the definition. But they always self-resolve eventually under 7 days. But you might have it for 3 days, right? And that's too long. Even a few hours is too long in terms of how you feel. But in the meantime, every time you're having an episode, you're adding slightly to the electrophysiological remodeling of the heart. And that's permanent. And so every minute you're in AF, every minute of AF burden, you're slightly progressing to the tune of 8 to 10% of people a year in that first bucket progress to the next one, which is persistent, where it doesn't self-resolve. And you have to go in and get electrical cardioversion because the pharmacological options of conversion aren't there. And then eventually it goes to permanent where nothing works. So what if every time you had a PAF episode, you could stop it within a few minutes so that the additive effect of all those minutes, hours, days of AF would be dramatically different? Guess what? There's nothing that can do that today. Believe it or not, all the innovation in the world in cardiology and the antiarrhythmic drugs that exist in the US have only been approved for chronic prevention, and they don't work very well. They're not tolerated. If you're having 3 to 5 episodes a year, why would you take a pill 365 days a year? That doesn't make you feel great. Now, if you had something that could stop it in minutes, if even when you went to the ER, never mind at home,
yep.
If they could give you something that you knew every time would have a high likelihood of returning you back to normal so you can go on with your day and reduce progression, that would dramatically change, right? That's what we're working on. We're working on an inhaled version of an antiarrhythmic. You can get it in at a lower dose through inhalation in a few minutes. We show we stop the episode in 3 minutes after you take the drug. So that would dramatically change the course of the disease and cost to the healthcare system.
Yep. One more thing I want to ask you, and then I'm going to let you go. But you mentioned earlier that sometimes you still sing musical theater. Yeah.
Yes.
So how did that start? And like, this to me also just is another example of kind of your well-rounded interests.
Yeah. Well, you know, Puerto Rico, growing up in Puerto Rico, is a very musical place. So like a lot of Latino cultures, everybody's singing all the time. Right. And my grandfather, the one I never met, was a huge lover of opera. So all of his kids, most of his kids have operatic names. Athos, Brunilda, Fedora. My father's name is Hector.
Really?
Yes. And the youngest of those eight was an opera singer, Evangelina Colon, my sweet aunt. Her daughter, Ana Maria Martinez, is a very well-known opera singer. She went to Juilliard undergrad and master's. She sings all over the world with Plácido. She's debuted at the Met and everything. So, wow. And my dad used to sing. He used to serenade my mom in her dorm in Lafayette with his guitar. And all the ladies would swoon at this handsome young Latino, you know, singing with his Ricky Ricardo accent. and which he had, I never realized he had until someone, you know, they both passed away many years ago, but people would say, your dad has such a cute accent. I'm like, what accent?
Oh,
I don't hear
yeah.
it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, so I grew up, you know, we'd have family parties, all generations mixing, everybody's playing guitar, piano. And so I grew up singing, did a lot of musicals in high school, and then, did musicals at Penn and MIT. They're fabulous. Yes. Oh, yes. I did about 15 shows when I was at MIT.
How did you have time for that?
You just, you know, no sleep, right? So you set up a microbial culture, go off to rehearsal, come back, spin it down, do whatever, go off, taught my aerobics class that I taught, came back and, you know, went across the river, come take fermentation samples, run them through the HPLC, have a few hours, go to rehearsal. So, you know, you do it all on the campus and it was so much fun. And so I love singing. I haven't done theater in a long time, but just recently I realized I still miss it a lot. So I've been doing a few little things here and there. I'm going to try to take it up. The hard part is, you know, in your career, it's hard to make time for a show because you have rehearsals and if you're traveling, it's really hard.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to come up with ways that when the pandemic is over, you know, it could be a cabaret night or it could be, you know, small performance type things. Right now I'm doing stuff online, but I'm not going to give you the links to those.
But the 15 that you did at MIT, I mean, what were some of the names? Am I going to know?
So I was Anita in West Side Story, of
yep.
course.
Okay.
I was Bloody Mary in South Pacific. I was, I did Sondheim. I did a lot of Gilbert and Sullivan. So that was,
I don't know that.
Those were all my peeps. So the Mikado, Pirates of Penzance, you know,
okay.
all of those
yeah.
types
yeah.
of things, right? So some modern, some more classic, right? So Pippin and A Little Night Music and, you know, all of those. So I have a whole list.
So just before the pandemic hit then, what was your current, I'm sure you keep up on musical theater then. What was your current number one that was still showing, like on Broadway?
That current number one that I like or that I...
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that you liked.
Oh my gosh, so many of them. Oh my God. Kinky Boots and Waitress. And I mean, just, you know, there's been so many amazing shows. Fun Home and Evan Hansen and Hamilton. And I mean, there's just a lot of great... I mean, I love Lin-Manuel, obviously, as a fellow Puerto Rican.
Yeah.
I would love to be in the Heights. I could play Abuela or the Puerto Rican Mom. But I, you know, there's just so much great stuff going on Broadway. It just breaks my heart what's going on right now, obviously. I mean, a lot of people have it really bad, right? But when we talk about Broadway, I think of them and it just breaks my heart.
I am going to let you go. I have to say that when Hamilton was at its heights, I couldn't get a ticket. No one could. And I put in for the lottery for me and my wife. And my third attempt, we won it. And we were in the front row middle. Front row.
I'm so jealous.
I couldn't believe it.
So jealous. That is
I've never won anything in my life.
I never saw it on the original run.
It was incredible.
That must have been amazing.
Listen, thank you for doing this. I'm going to let you go. appreciate the time, and I'll let you know when it's out.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. This was a blast.
Okay, there it is, your first Rounders podcast with Grace Colone. It's fun, right? So much fun. It's just, it's also a reminder. I live in New York City and I never go to the theater. Well, not never. I rarely go to the theater. Even before the pandemic, I rarely went to the theater. And that's a reminder that I should go more often. So thank you, Grace, for making me. I haven't seen Kinky Boots. I should go see Kinky Boots. Okay, if you have comments about this show, our journal, Nature Biotechnology, or anything that we do, you can find us on Twitter. Our handle is at Nature Biotech. Thank you to the Midwest Quiet for use of your music in this podcast. By the time you're listening to this, it'll be January 2021. You know, there's a lot of talk this year about 2020. What a terrible year. Will it ever end? Why is this year doing that to us? You know, I'm not a believer in the restrictions of the calendar in that way. That said, I'm glad to see it go. Here's to 2021. There's a vaccine coming, more than one. I will take that jab any way I can get it. I haven't seen my family in a year. So to better times for me and you both. That is all. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.